Is it close enough? Over here so I could see.
Okay.
I think. Okay, thanks everyone for coming. My name is Julie Schwartzman. I'm one of the rheumatology attendings, basically the Jacoby rheumatology attending. So I think I've seen a lot of you also on the medicine wards. And like I said, thanks again for coming. Today we're going to talk about rheumatoid arthritis, and I thought I'd start out with a case report. The patient is a 39-year-old white male diagnosed with seropositive rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 17, who presented to his primary care physician with shortness of breath and intermittent nausea. He had recently reduced his daily prednisone dose from 20 milligrams to 10 milligrams because of nausea, and he was on diclofenac 50 milligrams BID and tramadol TID. But at the time he presented to his primary care doctor, he was not on any DMARDs. In addition to the steroid therapy, several different disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs had been tried in the past, including sulfasalazine, gold, chloroquine, methotrexate, and the TNF inhibitors, all of which I'll discuss with all of you a little bit later. The patient had very serious disease. He already had had a total of 16 operations, including excision of nodules, tendon repair, and bilateral knee and unilateral hip replacement. On exam at the time that he presented to his PCP, he showed signs of extensive rheumatoid arthritis, most markedly on the hand, foot, shoulder joints, as well as nodules on both elbows. His heart rate was regular but tacky, blood pressure elevated at 130 over 90, and his SED rate came back at 82. A CAT scan at that time and an echocardiogram revealed a pericardial effusion and a thickened pericardium and basal bilateral low-grade lung fibrosis. Diuretic therapy and increased prednisone dose reduced his symptoms, and the effusion was almost undetectable 4 weeks later. About 4 months later, he was admitted to the hospital because of sudden onset of abdominal pain. And at that time, he was diagnosed with a perforated ulcer thought to be NSAID and steroid-induced, and he was rushed to emergency surgery. During anesthesia, severe cardiovascular problems developed, including low blood pressure, tachycardia, and renal failure. A left and right heart cath were performed, which showed a cardiac index of 2.4, equalization of left and right pressures, and he was very sick. He had an angiogram, which revealed a 75% obstruction in the diagonal. An MRI showed a thickened pericardium, a small pericardial effusion, enlarged right atrium, and bilateral pleural effusions. The patient was diagnosed with constrictive pericarditis without hemodynamically significant pericardial effusion. This was thought to be one of his extra-articular manifestations of his disease. He was referred to CT surgery. Pericardectomy was suggested, but he refused. He was informed about how sick he was, but he declined surgery, like I said, and his condition eventually slowly improved. Over the next several months, he was hospitalized repeatedly because of right heart failure. On his final admission, he presented with cachexia, extensive edema, tachycardia, low blood pressure, orthopnea, and ascites. He had a follow-up cath, which revealed reduced ventricular function and a decreased cardiac index. Surgical intervention was again recommended, but for whatever reason, the patient still declined. In the following weeks, he had 3 episodes of renal failure attributed to low blood pressure and diuretic therapy. He intermittently required vasopressors. A CT scan at that time showed a pericardial effusion, but it was not hemodynamically relevant. So this was the CT scan performed without contrast because of his renal failure. He had a thickened pericardium and bilateral pleural effusions. He was also adrenally insufficient and pancreatic insufficient. In the following weeks, cardiovascular and renal functions were increasingly difficult to stabilize. He just progressed and progressed. He developed a DVT. He developed bilateral pneumonia despite antibiotic therapy. And he later died in septic shock and multi-organ failure. So I wanted to start with this case because I know, you know, during residency, most of the cases that you see are cardiopulmonary, and most of the patients that are, you know, the most exciting, the most interesting to take care of are the ones who are the sickest, the unit patients. But I just want, you know, an RA is not typically thought of as a disease that involves these types of presentations. But I specifically wanted to start with that just because, you know, I've seen RA patients at their later stages of their articular manifestations. But I just want you to know that the extra-articular manifestations are just as relevant for certain patients, and they're just as they're associated with just as much morbidity and mortality. And he had pericarditis, which is a frequent extra-articular manifestation, and in postmortem studies, it was shown to be found in about 30 to 50% of patients, clinically relevant in only about 3% of patients. But this was a patient who, as I told you, had nodules, had had multiple surgeries. You know, he had, you know, failed many medications, so he's one of the candidates who's going to get the extra-articular manifestations. So, rheumatoid arthritis. As you know, it's a systemic polyarthritis based on inflammation leading to joint destruction, deformity, and loss of function. There's also, as I said, several potentially severe extra-articular manifestations, which we'll discuss. The pathology of RA involves the synovial membranes and periarticular structures of multiple joints, resulting in, as you know, pain, swelling, stiffness, uncontrolled inflammation, and this can lead to irreversible damage and deformity and functional limitation. So in order to diagnose RA, the patients have to meet 4 of 7 criteria. And, you know, as I always tell you, whenever we talk about classification criteria, these were established for the entrance of patients into clinical trials. So you may find patients that early in their disease course don't have exactly 4, but, you know, if you get a strong feeling and you, you know, go through the pathways of the baseline diagnostic procedures, you could diagnose a patient with RA if they don't have exactly 4 of 7. So the criteria are morning stiffness for at least 1 hour, swelling in 3 or more joints, swelling in the hand joints, symmetric joint swelling, erosions or decalcification of the x-ray of the hands, nodules, and an abnormal serum rheumatoid factor. The prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis is much less than the prevalence of osteoarthritis, but it is fairly significant at 0.5 to 2%, 2 to 3 more prevalent in women. Every time I check my review queue for the MYSIS system, I have mostly females in there between the RA and lupus patients. Increased prevalence with increasing age. There's up to 200,000 new cases diagnosed a year. About a fifth of patients actually present with one joint, even though we typically teach you, you know, monoarthritis, look for gout, rule out infection. You know, it may be reactive arthritis, but there's a fair percentage of patients who do present with one joint. It may be oligoarticular or polyarticular. More typically, the joints of the hands, the MCPs and PIPs, are involved in presentation. But, you know, up to half of the patients actually present with the ankle joint. And that, you know, the ankle joint is a joint that we tend to focus to rule out sarcoidosis or, you know, like I said, the other, the seronegative arthropathies, but it is seen in presentation in a fair percentage of patients with RA. About 10% of patients actually go into remission, and that's with treatment, and sometimes patients can be taken off treatment. I definitely haven't been practicing long enough to see that 10% population, the people who we can take off treatment, but I guess there is a fair number. Typically, patients have a progressive course, and that's why nowadays we're starting with, you know, early aggressive therapy from the onset. Okay, so feel free to call out. What are we showing here? What do you see? Belinda? I'm going to call on you because I know your name. Right, exactly. So, good. So we see MCP and PIP joint swelling, right? And these are, this is the classic set of joints. And in most pictures, they'll show you both hands because it's the symmetric polyarthritis. And here you go. This is, the bulk of this row of MCPs is swollen. What makes it look even more swollen is because the tendons are really lax here. This is years of destruction. And this is an X-ray, basically, of the same patient. I think the next one might be a little more. So, the typical X-ray findings, the earliest ones are periarticular osteopenia, which isn't so easy to see on this image, but, you would see in this general region, the osteopenic looking bones early in presentation if the patient has early findings. Some of the other findings that you may see are symmetric erosions. And symmetric erosions means not only symmetric on equal halves of the body, like both the left and right hand, but it should really be on both sides of the bone. So you may see an erosion here. I think this is the PIP joint of that patient. And similarly on the opposite side of the same bone. Okay. Erosion at the ulnar styloid process is a classic early presentation of RA. These are the patients who may have wrist pain. They may eventually develop carpal bone fusion, like you can see in this area over here. So what do we see here?
Swan neck.
Swan neck. A little swan necking here. And what about this? Right, if it's not swan neck, it's the other one, right? So what is that called? Okay, good. So this is also a patient with severe rheumatoid arthritis. And what do we see in this picture? What's this? Good, right. And what's another polyarthritis that may present with ulnar deviation that you may diagnose on physical exam? No?